You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 24.
I think there are multiple types of intelligences. You know, there's this sort of computational intelligence. You know, when you talk to people, there's emotional intelligence. When you look at the animals around, they have different types of intelligence in order to adapt.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Get excited, everyone. Time to get excited. Get really excited because the intro music is playing. That's why. All right. Welcome to another episode of The Local Maximum. That's what Rob Bernstein taught me the other day, by the way. I went on his podcast called Run Your Mouth Podcast a few days ago. Awesome experience. Started out with, you know, you better get excited because the intro music is playing. You might not hear it, but trust me, it's going to be there. But seriously, check out the latest episode of Run Your Mouth Podcast after you listen to this episode of The Local Maximum, of course. It's the one called Rooftop Porch Party. This is part of comic Rob Bernstein's porch tour, where he's doing his podcast in listeners' porches, or in my case, the garden in my building here in Brooklyn. I like the podcast because it's true to real-life conversation, or at least interesting conversations they have in real life. Some of the conversations they have in real life are kind of a real, you know, a real drag. But they talk about sandwiches and small stuff, and then they talk about news and the political situation. But you don't really have to be so stressed about it. It's not like the kind of stuff where it's going to make you sick to your stomach. But you're actually going to like learn a little bit about what's going on. And it cracks me up. So definitely worth your time. He did ask me about the future of AI, which is something that we're covering on this episode of The Local Maximum. We also talked about the Google story, where Google is being fined a lot of money by the European Union, and you know the nature of the antitrust laws that are behind it, and also some ideas for building a better dating app, which, you know, coming up with product ideas like that on the fly is always a good exercise. So check out my appearance on Run Your Mouth after you do this. Okay, because today we're talking to Christian Hubbs. Christian co-hosts a podcast along with Stephen Donnelly called Artificially Intelligent. Christian is in Pittsburgh and Stephen is in Belfast, Ireland. As it turns out, you know, I'm going to Belfast for the first time on Thursday. So very excited about that. You'll hear my next episode will be broadcast, or at least I'll upload it from Belfast. I might record parts of it from Belfast. I'll let you know if I am. Okay, so they cover all topics related to AI, both on the technical side and also as it connects to economics and philosophy and business. So if you like this show and you're a curious person, you know, artificial intelligence is worth checking out as part of your weekly rotation. Now, I started out on a small scale in this conversation and got bigger. So we're going to start with, you know, eating your vegetables, which I define as kind of the short-term stuff. What should I be studying? What industry should I look at? Should I be worried or concerned about my job? All that stuff. You know, is AI in a bubble right now? Is the bubble going to burst? Then after that, we kind of threw caution totally out the window and looked at the big picture. You know, what is the end game for AI? Is super intelligence coming? Will it replace us? Is the technological singularity coming? This goes deep, my friends. Then finally, I spoke to Christian about his interest and expertise in reinforcement learning and machines that can play games like Go and chess, which was the previous generation's Go. From his website, Christian said that he is a big economics, philosophy, and history nerd, reading a lot from the Austrian School of Economics, as well as classical history, particularly at the start of the Christian era. He studied at the Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio, and the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, Switzerland. He is currently a PhD student at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, working on data science, AI, and engineering. And as I said, also an expert in reinforcement learning. Thanks for coming on, Christian. Welcome to the show. Welcome to The Local Maximum.
Hey, Max. Thanks for having me.
I know you came on a few weeks ago just for a few minutes to tell us a little bit about your show on the same day that I was on your show. Why don't we just go over a little bit what your show is about. It's called Artificially Intelligent. It is a weekly show where you talk about issues in artificial intelligence and machine learning that are coming up in the news and in society. Tell us a little bit about where you're taking that show recently.
Yeah, so like you said, we run every week and we shoot for, 30, 45 minutes or so, and we really try to focus on how AI is impacting the economy. So we cover businesses, we cover bigger pictures such as joblessness or automation, what that's going to have. We look at, say, VC markets and a bunch of other things to really try to see how this technology is going to change lives through economics. And, my co-host and I, Stephen, we started this, back in early 2017, and we've been talking about it for a little while. And big reason was because both of us listen to a lot of podcasts, and I work in kind of doing a lot of this AI research and other things. He also has a graduate degree in economics, and we didn't really see anything out there that kind of hit these two areas at least very well or very consistently. And so we thought, this is something that we're both interested in. Let's try to talk about it. And not only that, I come from more of an Austrian economics perspective to bring that in. So I think it's a little bit more unique than what you might find elsewhere. If you listen to, say, maybe The Economist or Financial Times or what they might be doing when they talk about some of the AI stuff, Stephen's been trained more in the mainstream type of school. So we were able to have some good discussions about it. And I think it's a worthwhile endeavor. And so anybody listening wanted to check it out.
That's very good. Did you, when you decided to start it, did you have any podcasting experience, or were you simply coming at it from a technologist experience and this was how you wanted to get your content out there?
Yeah. So no experience whatsoever when we jumped in, and that can...
So I'm always curious, why choose a podcast? Why not a blog? I mean, I have my own answer on that, which is I tried the blog first and I couldn't keep up with it. But what made you decide, podcasting is the way to go?
Yeah, that's definitely, something I experienced too, because I have a blog that I maintain as well, but I don't update it nearly as much. I try to do maybe say once a month, but I think there's just a different standard typically when people look at a blog. Especially my blog tends to be a bit more technical, where I'll discuss algorithms and try to do some tutorials and other things like that. It's not really good for podcasting and vice versa. When you have a podcast, you can sit down, you can have a conversation, you can talk about some of these things, and it's just I find it's a lower barrier of entry. It's a better medium for discussing a number of topics. Whereas an article, you can post it, and if it can be just as in depth as a podcast, but I find fewer people tend to look at a lot of those articles or look at those blog posts. So. Yeah. And it's just a way to incorporate other people as well, because that's another thing we want to do, is to reach out and interview people. Like, we had you on the show and we've had other people in industry, and it's just easier to kind of expand that network and talk to others on that format.
Yeah. Yeah. I found the same thing. So I assume you were a podcast fan then before coming in. You had probably listened to a bunch of podcasts. You didn't find anything. There isn't a whole lot out there on this topic, but I'm sure you were, were there any podcasts that you were particularly a fan of that you kind of said, oh, this is a really good way of getting information out there. I want to be like this, or at least I'm a fan of this. I'm using it as inspiration.
Yeah. I mean, there are plenty of actual data science podcasts that have come out over the past few years. One of the big ones that was out at the time, but now defunct, is The Partially Derivative. There's This Week in Machine Learning and AI, which tends to be more technical. There's like NVIDIA, which focuses on, use cases. They have the AI, NVIDIA AI podcast or something like that. So, what you find typically out there are quite a few, but there are a lot that are a lot more technical, where they talk with researchers and others about their latest research and such. So, there's
some
a
of that
gamut.
Some of that's good. And some of that, like, I'd like to do on my show, but it's, some of them get way too dry and technical to be something that you're going to want to listen to on your ride home or get much use out of, is what I found.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think Sam Sherrington does a great job with the Twimmel AI podcast, and, I've had some correspondence with him, and he's, it's a really, really well done, but there's sometimes, at the end of the day, I'm tired and I don't want to put that one on. I'll listen to it later, you know, when I've had some rest or other things, just because it's hard to keep up. There's so much great information in it, but yeah, it's just, your brain just isn't always prepared for it.
Right. So you've been running this podcast for over a year now, and it helps people understand how AI is going to affect their lives in a direct and informed way. From what you've heard, what is the biggest misconception about AI, either from the media or from the popular consciousness, that needs to be corrected?
So jobs is a repeated issue that comes up all the time with people talking about automation and what that's going to mean for the future of work and for joblessness. And yeah, you know, Martin Ford, he wrote a book called The Rise of the Machines a few years ago, and he kind of paints this dystopian future of this oligarchy that's going to be taking over because they've invented artificial intelligence technologies that have displaced all the workers. And so you have this small cadre that has all the wealth and everybody else has no jobs. So they have so they're just living in abject poverty. And it's just, economically, that just doesn't really work out. I mean, who are these super wealthy oligarchs going to be selling their products to? You know, how's that going to work? Are they just going to be, you know, living on Mount Olympus, essentially, amongst themselves and, you know, watching the peasants below?
Similar to, like, you know, kind of the Marxist theory that a capital is going to continue to accumulate, you know, to a small group of people?
Yeah,
It sounds very rehashed a little bit.
Yeah, it's very, very similar idea, except in this case, it's really more around this technology aspect, that it's just going to continue to accumulate and everybody's going to be at this basically destitute as a result of what this technology is going to do, because they took our jobs, you know. And it's just something that we bring up quite a bit and we talk about a lot, because I think there are just a whole host of misunderstandings around this topic and what automation actually does for an economy and what it does for your standard of living.
Do you find that people are worried about their job in particular, or are they more worried about, well, something's going to happen and a lot of other people are going to be out of work and that's going to cause our society a problem? Or do you see people who are actually worried about their particular job?
I think it'll depend industry to industry, but by and large, from what I've read and what the people I've talked to and come across, is that most people tend to be worried about what's going to happen to just other people out there. Maybe nobody in particular. They talk about, oh yeah, it's going to happen, and all these people are going to be out of work. But most people don't see it as affecting themselves. Now, the few people that I've talked to that do see, okay, this might impact me, are those who are working on the assembly lines or kind of those more blue collar works or workers where automation has displaced a lot of work. But you know, most of the people I encounter are kind of in that first category I mentioned.
It's interesting. I feel like the people who kind of say, oh, a machine will never be able to do what I do, are the ones where then I flip and I become a little more skeptical. I'm like, wait a minute, there are definitely some aspects of what you do that a machine can do.
Absolutely.
But I tend to agree that, you know, there is, people tend to think it's always some other guy that is going to lose their job. It's not me.
Yeah.
Which is sort of interesting. If it's nobody in particular, if it's always someone else, then it's like, where's the issue going to be?
Yeah. And one of the things too that we try to stress a lot is people talk about jobs, but that's really not what gets automated. It's more tasks, you know, the parts of your job that you might do. So whether it's, you know, checking for emails or transactions or, you know, whatever it is that makes your job, you have a lot of little tasks that actually combine that job. And those tasks are what tend to get automated rather than an entire job, unless your job is just basically one task. And so I think it's more accurate to actually think about the tasks that are going to be automated, and you can start to see those coming. And once those start to occur, you know, it's always important to try to, you know, leverage that automation to free up your time to work on some other areas or to expand your responsibilities or your role, because now you have some leverage, and that can help you to be kind of this evergreen person working in your company.
Yeah, I have 2 points to make on that. First, one podcast I listened to is Tech 2025 with Charlie Oliver, and she was talking to someone a couple months ago about the trucking industry and the idea that there's going to be self-driving trucks. And I, there are a couple of things that I didn't know when I listened to that. One is that, you know, we need a lot of truckers right now, and there are very few people who are coming into the workforce who are interested in that. You know, most of the people who are doing that work are older, near retirement. So in the short term, it almost seems like they have a crisis of, you know, a labor shortage. Mm-hmm. But in the long term, it's like their conversation went into, oh, there's so much opportunity for figuring out, okay, like, you know, maybe the truck will drive itself for the most part. You can go longer distances. You're still going to have people in the trucks for the time being. You know, what sort of jobs are they going to do while they're in the truck? Like, you know, they could get on their laptop and start, you know, start doing other things, inventory checks or real time rerouting, or I don't know, whatever ideas they have. And then, you know, ultimately in several decades, when they don't want someone in every truck, then those jobs will just move from the truck to the office.
Yeah. I'm not sure precisely what they would be doing in the truck, but one thing, when you talk about like an employer, they always have more stuff to do. There's always something else to be done, and they always want more resources to do that. So if people are seeing that we're able to automate some tasks or some parts of your job, and that frees up time, you know, your boss probably has other stuff for you to go work on if you want, and you just have to put up your hand and go ask. And it's something that I've seen. You know, I work in a large Fortune 50 company, and you know, we see it all the time. As soon as we get a little bit of space over here, a manager is quick to say, hey, I see that, you know, you got 20% of your time now. Can we work on this now? Okay, can we work on that? There's always something new, always something happening, and so many opportunities. It kind of comes back to this whole idea when we talk about this joblessness and automation is the lump of labor fallacy, which is the idea that there's only a fixed amount of work to be done in an economy. And then once that's done, well, there's no more work left. And I think that's where a lot of these, you know, mass unemployment fears come from. And it's just not borne out by historical evidence and or you know, your day-to-day evidence, really.
So I think the one... not objection, but maybe, well, one point in that is people are going to have to be flexible. Like if they're used to doing a particular task, they have to be in the mindset. And most, you know, software engineers are in this mindset is like, well, one day, hopefully this will be automated and then I'll be on to the next thing. But maybe some people would be uncomfortable with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some people, I think, are resistant to change. And there is still that idea in a lot of places of, you know, working in a job and keeping that job until retirement. And but I think that that's really a small minority of people, that most people have been exposed to a lot of the disruption that's occurred over the past 20, 30 years, that they realize that, okay, you know, whether I want to change or not, I need to change and I need to adapt. And, you know, what they always say about necessity being the mother of all invention, or, you know, I guess in this case, your human reinvention, to be able to try to add new skills and other things so that you can continue to compete and survive and adapt.
Okay, yeah. So I want to cover multiple time spans with you today, how to think about AI in the short term first, and then we'll talk about more long-term stuff. In the short term, a lot of people I talk to are worried about, you know, or they're asking me, you know, what skills should I work on? How do I break in, or what industry should I invest in? So let's start with skills and industry. What use cases for artificial intelligence have a lot of promise and opportunity right now, as you see it?
So the big advances that we've seen from AI really come from the image recognition and the natural language processing side of things. As you're probably aware, you know, with this big deep learning advent that's come out there, the big initial use cases were around like ImageNet and training these things to be able to identify and tag all the stuff, or now through Google Translate, or, you know, you've got an Alexa in your room or something like that. Okay, good.
As we've talked about, I always spell it out when I'm talking because I'm afraid of it. we've experimented with this stuff at Foursquare a lot. We've done image recognition on all the photos that are coming in, and we do a lot of natural language processing. I mean, right now, the NLP stuff is the stuff that's made it into the app as the show that's coming out tomorrow with Chris Conception. We're going to talk about that. So So yes, we are very familiar with that.
Yeah, and there are tons of use cases, you know, especially like low hanging fruit around these types of areas. So, for example, if you're in a manufacturing environment, think about how some of these image recognition systems can be used for inspections, for checking pipes or cords, see if they're frayed or other things like that, especially in places that are hard to get to, hard to reach, or that have to be regularly inspected, but may pose a hazard or a danger to a human to go in. You know, there are a lot of opportunities for using maybe some robotics combined with some of this image recognition classification technology to go into these areas, these confined spaces and other things, and see, okay, can we find a crack, or can we just ensure that everything's okay for our usual inspection? There's a big opportunity, and that's going to be huge for a lot of people, because that's going to help cut down on workplace injuries and accidents, and hopefully make things just run more efficiently, because you can start to maybe not fully automate all these, because sometimes, you know, maybe moving that robot or that drone around, you don't have a specific flight pattern, but you can at least send something in there to go and identify this stuff for you on your own. So that's one probably more low-hanging fruit or easier use case, where you can take some of these APIs off the shelf, you know, train them on some images that you have, assuming that you have the data of that area, or you can maybe generate it actually using some GANs or something along those lines to see what, you know, these cracks or this corrosion issues might look like, and then be able to go and put that into play.
Yeah, this is starting to happen now. I think, oh God, I don't remember. I remember some situation where I was seeing image recognition was being used to sort a certain product in terms of defective or not, or mm-hmm. maybe it was sorting some kind of fruits or something. I don't remember what it was, but
was it the cucumber machine?
Definitely used. I don't think it was the cucumber machine, but tell me about the cucumber machine.
So this was something where...
I think it was a cocoa bean machine. I think I went to a chocolate factory down here in Red Hook. That's what it was.
Oh, okay. Well, the cucumbers, it's something very similar. I think it was a Japanese farmer was trying to sort their cucumbers basically on quality, because you get a better price at the market with a certain, you know, aesthetically pleasing cucumbers, apparently. And I'm not sure about how you segment the cucumber market, but, you know, they were able to figure out so that they could actually classify it and then sort the cucumbers just by getting a few TensorFlow APIs and having something run automatically, and then put that into their conveyor belts to be able to sort things out. So yeah, that's one case where you can try to work on this image classification recognition.
Wait, so they were sorting for how aesthetically pleasing the cucumber is? How do you define? Is it like, so I could see that you're, you know, sort by, you know, whether it's the weight or the size or whatever, how much cucumber you're getting, but what exactly, that this could be something where there's a whole bunch of features where it's just like, is somebody going to see that on the shelf and be like, yep, I'm going to pick that one.
Yeah, because, you know, you got to go through and manually label all of these things too, right? So that's basically where you start. You have these photos, you have to label them and determine whether this is, you know, a good high quality cucumber or a low quality cucumber, or
just see,
you know,
which ones people actually buy.
Yeah. And I think that they have some ideas about, you know, certain sizes. You don't want it under a certain size, or you want them to be more straight or less bendy, whatever it is, smoother. I don't know all the details. I'm not a cucumber expert, but it's one of the early examples I had seen for agriculture and produce, and how they kind of can use some of this type of classification to help them go to market. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of agricultural, you know, applications, which is interesting to me because it's something that I don't know about so much, mm-hmm. having not, you know, been on a farm. But, you know, there's one company that has, you know, whatever, billions of pictures of heads of lettuce or something like that, and can determine, you know, which ones are better, which ones are worse, what, you know, what treatments to give different crops. All that stuff is going on right now.
Yeah.
I have here, maybe we can make a few predictions. A good one in this area would be the whole self-driving car thing, which I know that you've been talking about or covering a little bit on your program. What do you think is the timeline on that? Because that's been a source of a lot of speculation and, you know, fear versus hype over the last few years.
Yeah. So let's add to the speculation here. So it's a,
sure.
No, it's, it's tough to say, because I mean, Elon Musk, I think back in 2015, he said that they were going to have it out by 2018 for Tesla.
Yeah.
And that doesn't look like it's going to happen.
It's the same thing with all these space companies when they're like, we're going to get, you know, people out into space for the next, like in 2 years. And we're always seems to be 2 years away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think you had introduced me to the heuristic of saying like the 5 to 10 years is far enough that it's nobody's going to hold your feet to the fire, but it may happen, you know, that kind of thing where you're just really hedging your bets. So we'll try to avoid that a little bit. But I mean, I think it's going to be a couple of years still. Uber has just, I think, a couple weeks ago announced that they're going to suspend their driving through the summer, hopefully renew it or at the end of the summer, because they're trying to retrain some of their technicians who are out there in Pittsburgh and in Arizona following the accident that they had back in March. We haven't really seen a whole lot out of Waymo over the past couple of months since they had for new accomplishments. Tesla still hasn't come up with stuff. I mean, I'm starting to think that self-driving cars might be taking a little bit longer than most people had initially estimated, and myself included with that. I thought, you know, by the end of 2020, we'd probably have these out there, you know, back in 2015 when I was thinking about this. But now I'm thinking it might be more into the mid, 2023, 2024, maybe, which I wish I could be more optimistic, but it seems like there tend to be these issues that continue to pop up and it just never quite gets there. But I'm not super close to the industry myself. So it's just kind of the feeling that I get from reading up on it, reading a lot of the articles and talking to some of the people who are working a little bit more closely.
Having been watching this for several years, does seem to me that like there is real progress mm-hmm. being made. It's not like, you know, it's not like empty promises. And I think if it does end up being commercialized, you have to go through this period where there are crashes.
Yeah.
And people have to figure out what to do. And so it almost seems like the current period that we're in is inevitable in some ways. I had a timeline that I wrote out on that. I think probably, I mean, I guess maybe a little more pessimistic than you, but I'm like very optimistic that it'll happen. I just think like, you know, I think maybe I'm more on like the 10-year plan.
Matter of time, but it's just,
yeah.
When is the time going to be? And it's tough to really say, because you've had rumblings coming out of Congress about regulation, and which is likely going to slow down progress if they start to get involved in a lot of these. You know, there's been quite a bit of backlash against Uber for the accident, obviously. You know, that's an accident that really shouldn't have happened, because as this lady was crossing, I mean, it was completely dark. A human would have run her over. I promise you, like if you watch the video, there's no way you would have avoided that. But at the same time, their LiDAR and their sensors were picking her up, but they weren't able to identify it. And so it just continued to go forward without stopping until it was too late. And so the technology should have notified her or notified the driver and made the stop, automatically. But, you know, with all the stuff that's been occurring, you wonder if these companies are going to start to try to maybe slow down. And we're seeing that they're taking some stuff off the road to try to work on some things in the background, and that's, you know, making it safer. But I think it might slow down a little bit of the progress a bit, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, not necessarily a bad thing. No. If you think about it, you know, a human might make a mistake on the road like that, and then a few years later, another human in another city will make the exact same mistake. But at least in this case, you know, the mistake can be fixed in software and can be, spread out throughout the entire system. So in other words, once a car makes a horrible mistake like this, as horrible as it is, it's you can get a fix for it that then gets installed in every car. And so if they go a little slow and sort of start to see where the problems are before those problems cause bigger accidents than they otherwise would have by going fast, then ultimately when they do get there, maybe they'll get stronger for it.
Yeah, and that's the hope, is that it's going to improve things in the long run. And one of the things that's tough when you talk to people who are, you know, maybe outside this area, just ask the kind of man on the street about self-driving cars, and they hear about these accidents, and you know, they're very concerned about safety, obviously, as I think that they should be. But And even when you hear what's coming out of Washington and some of these regulatory agencies, it does become a little bit frustrating, because if these are able to show, say, maybe a 5% reduction in accidents, say today, you know, for example, I don't know what the numbers would look like, but
yeah,
let's say that we got a 5% overall reduction in accidents. There are about 35 to 40,000 deaths on U.S. highways a year. I mean, a 5% reduction in deaths, I mean, that's saving lives out there. I mean, they're still not 100% safe. And I think that's one of the difficulties that they're running into, is that these are billed as being safer, which they will be, but people are kind of expecting this large, you know, step forward in safety, maybe not this kind of incremental or gradual move forward, which, you know, again, every accident is super high profile. And so it kind of tarnishes it, and people are more likely and more comfortable trusting themselves rather than a machine, even if it is, say, 5% safer or 10% or more so, just because it has had some failures in the past.
Yeah, I understand the impulse to want to have more control, mm-hmm. even if it is, even if it's, you know, not as safe, you know, statistically. I think I can understand that. Even though I'd be happy to get into a self-driving car that's safe, I do not. I'm the only person who doesn't trust myself on the road. What do they say? Like, everyone thinks that they're
above average
driver. Yeah, no, I know I'm below average, because first of all, I don't drive very often. And when I do, now, fortunately, I've been able to avoid an accident because I'm so, you know, I'm so cautious when I do get behind the wheel, but, you know, it's still because I'm scared to death every time I do. Okay. All right. So now on to the investment side. I know that you covered back in 2017, some companies that seem to have an awfully high valuation without a proven product. So this suggests that we may be at the peak of the hype cycle for AI, but you could never be sure. And so I hate to be all go all Game of Thrones on you, but is AI winter coming? And first, let's define AI winter, because that's a term that a lot of AI researchers and entrepreneurs know about, but maybe not the general audience.
Yeah, so AI winter is something that came about after the artificial intelligence research community saw this massive evaporation of funds that came their way. And actually, we did a podcast on this exact topic, a couple of weeks ago. And it happened, I think, first time in the 60s, and then again, 70s and 80s, in the 80s up until the 90s, where the funding, which was primarily driven by the U.S. government, by DARPA and some of these other U.S. agencies, they were putting a lot of money into it, but then the results just didn't really quite match up with the hype. So one of the early results that they were looking at was translation from Russian to English. And this is kind of precipitated the first AI winter. And you can think back in the 60s, Cold War, this was a huge, huge deal. There were some early results that said, okay, we can actually translate this using AI, but it stalled out pretty darn quickly. And once that happened, some of the funding started to dry up. And then there were some additional breakthroughs that happened kind of behind closed doors in the background with that reduced amount of funding. And that led to the advent of, say, like of these expert systems and other things that came about in the 80s and into the 90s. And then when those were shown to be more brittle, a lot of the funding then dried up again. So they would get these sort of peaks and these valleys between getting a lot of the funding. It was really driven by government spending more than anything else. And so a lot of people are concerned about another AI winter coming in the future because of all the hype that's occurred around the technology. I mean, you see it everywhere. You see it, like you said, we talked about some of these VC funds and others that are going out there and putting money into these startups without any product, that have been going on for quite some time. And they have no market, no revenue, nothing like that. And they're getting billion-dollar valuations because of their AI technology, basically. And you just think, wow, is this another bubble? And I think a lot of the signs point to, yeah, this is another big bubble, and it could lead to this contraction of funding for researchers in the near term if the bubble winds up popping, and the third AI winter is basically what would result.
Do you think there are any opportunities that present itself during the AI winter?
Yeah, definitely. There are opportunities in any market, you know, whether you're going up or whether you're going down, you can find stuff. It's just going to be a lot harder to raise the funds and other things, but it tends to be good for the markets and the industries actually when they kind of go through these contractions, because they have to really double down on their value proposition and their use case, rather than you know, thinking about these big grand ideas. But they really need to focus more on what kind of value can they deliver, how is that going to move the bottom line, and how is it going to actually benefit their customers as they go out to market. So it's basically a correction, as a lot of the funds have to be redirected to other areas of the economy after this.
Right. It's interesting that you mentioned, you know, Russian translation during the Cold War in the 1960s, that it didn't pan out in the way that it did, because the technology wasn't there yet. But like, imagine if I came, you know, if I, you know, got a grant in the 60s and I came back to them and I presented, you know, hey, I present to you Google Translate. They would have been like, holy crap, I would have paid an extra $1 trillion for this, you know?
Yeah.
But it's just not feasible to do it at that time.
Yeah, and you know, it takes time for this stuff to develop. And what we're seeing now versus previous forms of AI is really this data-driven artificial intelligence, which it represents. So with the explosion of the internet and all this other stuff that we have, and the massive computing power, you know, the continued march of Moore's Law, which is starting to break down, actually has been for a couple of years now, but we have more data, we have more computational space, and more of it's available, as well as some algorithmic breakthroughs as well. But still, even this deep learning stuff is still been around for a little while. It's just we haven't had the data to be able to feed these algorithms. You know, we haven't had Google size data, et cetera, or Amazon or Facebook to be able to make this stuff work, because all these techniques coming from deep learning are very data hungry. And so even if you were able to take these same techniques and the same compute power, you know, two of those three aspects that we need back to the 60s, you probably still wouldn't be able to make it work, just because you wouldn't have as much labeled use cases in order to make it to get something off the ground, so you can get these effective translation systems.
Yeah, right. Do you think that the whole idea of data-driven AI, in other words, it does matter what algorithm we use, but what's important is we have a whole lot of data. But you've mentioned that, you know, human beings can learn with much fewer data. Mm-hmm. There are some algorithms you have out there that learn with, you know, try to attempt to learn with less data. Do you think there's a possibility of moving towards, research, and how do you learn from less data? Or is it going to, you know, with the Internet of Things, just be hypercharged into okay, now we want to go to the next order of magnitude? I mean, I guess I'm just leaving that as an open question. It could go either way.
There are people who are actively working on trying to reduce the amount of data that they need to feed these algorithms, because it does become very valuable if you can, say, learn from 10 examples instead of 10,000 or 100,000 examples, because there are some data points that are just very difficult to acquire, or maybe you're trying to predict rare events that might not occur very often. So there's a ton of value in trying to reduce that as much as possible.
Oh, that's very relevant to what I'm doing now. I'm trying to predict visits, you know, to chains. That's, you know, if I predict your visit to a Taco Bell, well, what am I going to, I don't have that many examples.
Yeah. I mean, I was working with somebody earlier this week down in the Houston area, and we were talking about how to do some of this predictive maintenance type of work. And they have, you know, four examples of, say a pump, and they've had, you know, five failures in 10 years, and they're trying to predict it. They've got tons of data because, you know, it's sampling at, you know, whatever 60 hertz or whatever the sample rate is for the temperature, for the vibration measurements, et cetera. So even if you have all that data, but you only have five examples that you're trying to learn from, you know, it becomes tough to try to predict this in advance.
Yeah. I found that very early on, that scarce data is a thing that comes up over and over again. I mean, there are a lot of situations where you have, you know, data is cheap. I mean, some of the, like character recognition, I think, you know, the data is cheap to get more examples of the letter A. But in a lot of real world cases, you have a scarcity of the label that you're trying to learn. Mm-hmm. Okay, So now we get to the fun part, and that's talking about the long term. When we think about artificial intelligence, people like to project to an end game. You know, where is this all leading? So some people suggest that we're heading for a singularity around the middle of the century, followed by an out of control super intelligence that emerges from a single point, like some lab somewhere, and then it surpasses and completely replaces all life on Earth, and we're all of a sudden, you know, irrelevant. And on the other end of the spectrum, there are people who think that, well, you know, even just general intelligence isn't impossible, and we're just going to be stuck with kind of learning better and better narrow AI systems, and it'll get a little better in 50 years, but that's kind of the best that we can expect. So I guess my question is, and I think you've mentioned both sides of the argument on your show, and so I guess I want to ask you, on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is, you know, narrow AI only, and 10 is super intelligence wipes us all out with perfect information. Where do you fall?
Yeah, I'll put myself at like a 3 on that scale, maybe.
Interesting.
I'm not concerned about the super intelligence side of things at all. But I think that, you know, we are going to get some good advances through the narrow AI space. And I don't really have a super tight, airtight argument against AGI. I've been thinking about it for a while. But I think there are a lot of things that you can point to. For example, when you think about intelligence, so Nick Bostrom is over at Oxford. He wrote this book called Superintelligence a few years back. And it's kind of been the main siren for this super intelligence explosion. And the way that he visualizes intelligence is really on this single axis scale, that it's just going to be able to continuously increase without bound, without limits, in this single dimension of just intelligence. And I don't think that actually is accurate. So when you think about intelligence in general, I think there are multiple types of intelligences. You know, there's this sort of computational intelligence. You know, when you talk to people, there's emotional intelligence. When you look at the animals around, they have different types of intelligence in order to adapt. So first, I think that there are, you know, different types of intelligence that can be used or leveraged, and not really this kind of single overall number that we can qualify or quantify this as. And the other thing too is this type of runaway exponential growth. I'm not sure if that's even plausible to think about it as being this sort of limitless intelligence, even if it was on the single dimension that can continue without bound.
So, I mean, let's make a distinction here between super intelligence and general intelligence. There is a difference, right?
Yeah.
Between just. Yeah.
Yeah. So like when you talk about artificial general intelligence versus this super intelligence, right? Is that the distinction?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So people, when they think about it, oftentimes conflate the two. So the super intelligence is really that runaway of artificial general intelligence, where this AGI is this idea of basically being able to replicate human intelligence in silicon. So kind of this all-purpose learning algorithm. And there's debate even over that. Like, I mean, I'm not sure that humans are this all-purpose learning algorithm or anything like that to begin with. But that's kind of what most people have in mind. They tend to anthropomorphize it and think about humans just being able to do it more and more in this AGI.
But couldn't you say it's like there's some things are more general and some things are more specific, and maybe it's a sliding scale. And so what we call general is somewhere in the vicinity of what a human can do.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what most people have in mind when they talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it sounds like, tell me if I'm wrong, that on AGI, you're kind of a maybe, and on super intelligence, you're probably not.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that would classify it. I think that you can get, these narrow AI systems to work together in concert, potentially in the future. You can start to replicate some human behavior in a lot of these, in these areas. But I don't ever see this kind of runaway super intelligence. I mean, there are limits on stuff, be it physical limits, energy limits, you know, whatever it is. We don't know what that's going to take or what that's going to look like. If you're going to have something that's going to replicate or be this, you know, it's tough because you want to kind of quantify this stuff, but I don't, you don't, you know, say something with 2000 IQ points or 20,000 or something like that. How much, what kind of resources is that going to require? Is that even going to be something that is feasible given the energy available to it?
One of the examples that you gave on your program, which really hit home, like to me, described very well how different the thought process, if you can call it a thought process, than these machines are, is the Go machine that learned to beat humans on a Go board, which is 19 by 19. But when it changed to a 20 by 20 board, it just doesn't know what to do.
Yeah, essentially, that's the case. So,
I mean, that's crazy to me, because a human who masters Go, you could think, okay, if I moved to a 20 by 20 board or even chess or whatever, I add an extra row, I still kind of know how to play. Maybe I'm not, I'll still, I still have to adjust a little bit, but that should be an easy problem. And it's amazing, even like a deep learned, super powerful system can't handle something simple like that, which tells me there's still like some of what we would call brittleness from the human experience side.
Absolutely. And that's really the state of where this technology is today, is it is very brittle. If you start to have basically this kind of non-stationary domain or, the probability distribution or the environment that it's operating in starts to change, then it becomes very, very difficult to generalize. And, this is another reason why the self-driving cars, I think, are taking longer than anticipated, is because there are so many more edge cases and so much more variety out there than people might realize at first, because it's easy for us to process that. Like you said, you can add another row to your chessboard and it's going to be a little bit of a wonky game, but you're able to deal with it, just like you can drive in London, on the left-hand side. And it's
like, if I change the rules on what the queen can do, it's like, okay, well, some of the things that, maybe some of my instincts might be off, but I'll deal with it. I could still play a decent game of chess.
Yeah. Whereas these systems would have to entirely relearn it and say, okay, there might be some transfer learning that could take place, but by and large, they would have to, try to do it from scratch.
Right. So that to me seems like a key difference, and it's not necessarily something you could quantify, but it seems like evidence that we're still doing narrow learning and not general learning.
Yeah, exactly. And again, this is where we come back, where, I'm kind of 50-50 on where this general intelligence could actually occur.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there'll be room for lots of fascinating discussions as we see things play out, even over the next few years. All right. So I do want to ask you a little bit about your one of your fields of research, which is reinforcement learning. I was thinking about that we would do a whole show on at some point, but my experience in machine learning is I'm less familiar with this because I'm more versed in sort of traditional supervised and unsupervised learning. So is there an easy kind of definition of reinforcement learning that you can give, just to give people a little taste, and then maybe we'll talk about it in a future show?
Yeah. So reinforcement learning is really about training an agent to act and in an environment and to learn from that sort of feedback. So when you think about unsupervised learning, you're trying to understand patterns within the data, right? Doing some clustering algorithms or something like that. Supervised learning, you're trying to learn from this labeled data and trying to be able to accurately predict what's going to happen when stuff comes in. Now, reinforcement learning, you don't have any labels. You just basically have an agent that starts to try to learn how to play a game. So take Go, for example. This was trained through reinforcement learning. There was some supervised learning in the early iterations, but for AlphaGo, they basically just said, okay, here's some Go games. Make some moves and you play against another version, another AI version of yourself, copies, and then you find out what happens at the end when you win. If you win, you get a signal of, positive one. So you get a good reward. If you lose, negative one. And the idea is to be able to try to change it so that you can learn to get that signal more and more, to maximize that, to optimize for getting that positive reward signal. And so that's kind of the basic
idea of it. Yeah. So it sounds like instead of labeled data, where you're trying to predict the labels, you're sort of trying to take one step back and try to figure out how do you get that ultimate reward. But there could be some, what am I thinking? Like some side things that you need to focus on before you get that reward. So it's almost like, you know, running a business or something where you know, you have to be like, okay, you know, my goal is to earn profit, but you know, first I have to, I don't know, sweep the floor or hire someone or something like that. So it sounds like in reinforcement learning, do you have to figure out what the sub goals are?
So you could, they'll learn strategies along those lines. So for example, you know, playing with this AlphaGo thing, when Google DeepMind had rolled it out against Lee Sedol, there was a move, I think it was in the second game, where it had made that nobody had anticipated at all. Like it was playing at a very high level. You know, it was playing against a 18-time world champion Go player in this very complex game, much more complex than chess, as far as, you know, your number of spaces that are number search space and number of actions that you can actually take.
Right.
And it made this move that people just didn't anticipate. It had like a 1 in 10,000 probability of a human actually making that move is what it had calculated. Mm. And it chose to go here and just completely threw everybody off. And it became the beautiful move because it found this kind of new strategy, this new way of playing that people, even in the 3,000 year history of Go, hadn't explored before. So in that sense, yeah, you find these different strategies, these different ways of taking actions in order to get that reward, you know. So if it's running a business or whatever, you know, getting your profit. But, you know, even there, the business, it becomes very difficult because the action space, the search space is so huge. You know, we're not ready for for applying reinforcement learning to that kind of stuff. You got to keep it a little bit more confined to something that's well-defined. And that's what makes it interesting, but also challenging. And why you don't have a whole lot of industrial applications for reinforcement learning is because you really do need a lot of data. You typically need to learn from simulators or something like that. And because it's hard to narrow down into those narrow areas of a task to be able to train something like this.
Now, if you have a reinforcement learning system playing Go, does it get feedback before the game is over? Like, for example, midway through the game, does it know, oh man, some of these decisions I made were pretty bad. Maybe I should change my strategy because now I'm in a pretty bad situation. Or does it not know whether it's in a bad situation because it doesn't know whether it's won yet or not? In other words, can it only learn until it gets the final reward? And is that why you need to play so many games? Or can you somehow have it learn midway?
Well, if it doesn't have a signal coming back, so that reward right. signal, which is just a scalar 1 or 0 in this case at the end, it doesn't really have anything to learn off of. You know, you don't have any way to update your weights until you get a value. So in the Go case, you really have to do it kind of at the end and then run your back prop. But there are other environments that, you know, you might be able to get, you'll get a reward every time step, every iteration that you take. So for example, OpenAI, which is one of the groups that does a lot of research on this, that's sponsored by Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and others. They have this OpenAI gym environment with Atari games and other things that you can play with. So you can actually take some of these reinforcement learning algorithms and environments and play with them. So there might be some that you get a reward every step. And in that case, you can run, say, like a end step actor critic algorithm or something like that, where you're updating online. And so you have these different algorithms that are online learners. So they'll learn continuously as they go, such as cue learning or other things like that. And then you have these others that are considered, you know, like Monte Carlo algorithms, which will only update at the very end of the episode or the game or whatever you're trying to do.
So what are the applications that you look at specifically for reinforcement learning?
So for my research, I'm primarily focused on how do we use this type of technology in manufacturing environments. So particularly with the scheduling problems, because this is a combinatorial optimization problem that you wind up running into, and you're trying to maximize a certain reward in your reward function, however you may define that, be it.
Yeah, and way too many options for brute force.
Yeah, exactly. And so there are optimization algorithms that are out there. So you can model this as like an MILP, a mixed integer linear program, or something like that, to be able to get a global optimum in depending on the solver and you know the geometry of the problem that you're trying to deal with. But I'm trying to see if we can actually maybe use deep reinforcement learning in conjunction with this, or, you know, see where some of the trade-offs are in these areas. Because in a lot of cases, it's very useful if you can actually learn from some of the data. It's easier to set it up. And if you have a lot of data for some of these systems, maybe for like a control system application or something like that, where you might not be able to model, say, everything that's happening inside the system, but you still want to be able to control it, you know, how do you address that? You can't necessarily just put a model predictive controller on top of that because you don't know what's happening on the inside. So you got to, oftentimes what happens are people will develop some heuristics or, tuning some knobs and some PID controllers or something like that in order to control it. So maybe these data-driven approaches such as deep reinforcement learning can help to actually give us some better results in those areas. Or like I said, with my scheduling problems, sometimes it's not feasible to model a lot of these systems at the detail that you would need in order to run an optimization algorithm on top of it. So can we get better results from using some of these other approaches? So that's kind of where I'm focused a little bit. And I could go into tons of detail on that, but
I'm sure. Well, that's fascinating. I think we covered a lot of ground today. I think this is going to be one of the longer show notes pages, if I could say, perhaps the longest one I've ever done, because we referenced so many things today. So thanks a lot for coming on. Just one more thing. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to what we've already said today? And also, where can people find your podcast and all of your other stuff on the internet?
Yes. Yeah, so you can find my podcast at artificiallyintelligent.tech. And I have a blog at datahubs.com with two B's, you know, a little play on words there of sorts. And it's just, this is, I think, a really fascinating and exciting area. And I'm excited to see how it develops in time. And it's fun to be a part of it, you know, on the podcasting side, to be able to keep an eye and on some of these things, to talk with people who are working in various areas, and also just on the research side. I mean, there's stuff coming out all the time. It's tough to stay on top of. You've got so many papers that you've always got to read. I think I saw something, some stat on Archive, that there are a few dozen papers just on the deep learning area alone that come out on a daily basis. And I mean, how do you go through that? But it's very fast moving and it's very exciting. And so, yeah. There's tons of stuff out there and resources. And if anybody's interested in learning more about any things that we discussed, you know, reach out to me. You can find us through our blog or on Twitter, wherever it may be.
All right, great. And I'll post all of that on our show notes page. Thanks so much, Christian, for coming on the show today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Max. It's been good.
All right, a few notes. All this talk about winning games of chess and Go and the fact that an algorithm, you know, can't win on a 20-square board once it learns on a 19. You know, I've been thinking about that, and I wonder if there could be some kind of general competition for turn-based gameplay. The way it would work, you know, in my mind, is that you define some language or data structure through which to define the game. This means that, you know, you can define the rules for chess, you could define the rules for checkers, you could define the rules for Go, or let's say any like non-chance-based turn game. Or maybe we can do a chance-based game as well. That way you could have like, you know, backgammon or something like that. And then, you know, the people building the algorithms, the competitors, they won't know what the games are beforehand. So in other words, it only learns about the game rules on site and has to kind of figure out beforehand how it's going to learn how to play a general game. And, you know, when you come to the competition, there are various games to play. So I wonder if such an AI competition would produce a winner that's any good after a while. And, you know, furthermore, I wonder if we'll get people thinking about how to make AI more generalized. And this could be a good thing to fixing some of the brittleness of AI that we spoke about, and that's a problem in certain situations. It could also, you know, bring about the singularity. So who knows, good or bad? Just through playing games? I don't know. Maybe. All right. Also, I said I was on the 10-year plan for self-driving cars. I'm a little bit, you know, that's usually not what I've consistent with what I've said in the past. So maybe I want to clarify that a little bit. I actually think that the 2030s are going to be when people are going to start saying, you know what, I don't really need traditional driving anymore. you know, not that traditional driving goes away immediately or something like that, you know, like linear TV doesn't go away or print media doesn't go away. That sticks around for a long time, but it'll kind of be seen as yesterday's technology. And in terms of seeing a consumer launch for a self-driving car, I do think it'll be in the next decade. So maybe I am on the 5-year plan, the 5 to 10 year plan, as Christian said, you know, the one where, you know, that's that's the danger zone where you're like, you're just putting it off just enough. But we're so close after all. And all these companies like Waymo and Uber and Tesla, they're going to want to start to see a return on their multi-billion dollar research investment. No question about it. And but they are patient. You know, they wouldn't have made that investment otherwise. All right. The next couple of weeks look good. I'm going to talk to Chris Messina on conversational commerce. He knows what he's talking about. That's bots. We kind of talked about his article before and his appearance on another podcast, but now you'll get the details from him firsthand. Also, I want to talk about Twitter and their purge of the bots. You know, are they going to be successful? What are the pitfalls in what they're trying to do, and how is this all going to play out? So you're going to get my take next time. All right, thanks for listening. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. If you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. If you want to keep up, remember to follow the Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account @MaxSklar. Have a great week.
Feel the power.
I don't care what you say. You're gonna